Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. The music of Gershwin, the original, George, that is, on a piano roll. It's a selection of our guest, Jack Miles. Jack Miles is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author who, around 15 years ago, earned much praise and endured some aggravation with the publication of his two-volume journey through the life of God, In God, A Biography, and Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God. Miles put the Jewish and Christian canons under the lens not of biblical or historical criticism, but of searching literary analysis. For many, what resulted was a revelation. For others, an affront to either their faith or their cherished discipline. What Miles sought was to understand the God of the Bible not as a determined set of theological propositions or a reduced shard of Palestinian history, but as a literary character in a grand dramatic work pulled together over time from multiple sources and many perspectives. One useful analogy was to witness statements in a courtroom, each shedding some light on events and individuals, but none with the whole picture, eventually assembled for either the prosecution or the defence. The model character suggested by Miles is Hamlet, a suggestion to which we will turn later. Jack Miles, welcome to Sunday Night.
A pleasure to join you, John.
One of the things you usefully point out in the biography of God is whether we believe in God or not, we need to come to terms with the Bible because in a quite profound way, it continues to shape who we are.
I believe that to be the case because for so many centuries, the Bible was the one book that was constantly heard and constantly read. Church attendance was obligatory in Britain after Henry VIII, and it was always the same translation, the King James translation, that was heard after a while. So by dint of repetition, the cadences of the language, but also the shape of the central character, entered the consciousness of the English people and began a life there that meant that parents were transmitting ideas about God to their children, whether any reference was made to the Bible or not. So in this way, a work of literature from West Asia began to shape the very self-understanding of a Western country.
Yes, it comes out particularly, you point to that Elizabethan age or the Jacobean age with Shakespeare, because at that time, of course, too, the King James Bible is being written. And it seems an almost sort of appropriate moment for that to happen when you get a literary canon that explodes because it's needed in a way.
Well, yes. At the beginning, of course, the notion of translating the Bible into the vernacular languages had a kind of anarchic edge to it. And every plowboy was going to be the equal of every divine and even of the king. Well, the kings weren't going to let that happen, were they? And so you had the anomaly of the King James version of the Bible. Where does a king come into the Bible? Because he had to exert control over something he knew was as influential as this text could be. Now that it was in English, all the more influential.
One of the things that I think you contributed, and perhaps was one of the things that also aggravated people, was that for readers of the Old Testament, you provided an overarching view that ordinary readers could grasp and say, actually now I know what all this stuff is talking about. Mm-hmm. That, for many, provided a really useful way of looking at things. Then along comes your second book, Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God. And this was touching stuff that people thought they knew.
Yes.
And it provided a deal more aggravation.
Much more. It's a much shorter book, but it's a far more densely written book and far more intellectually challenging, I realize. Because, in a sense, it announces a kind of failure on God's part in his first gigantic attempt.
We'll get to some of that in a moment. You wrote both books, I've mentioned, before the events of 2001, and I'd like to spend a little time with that shortly. But first, let's remind ourselves of the journey you took us on in those books and the impact they had. In The Biography of God, you describe a God who, from his first appearance, is indirectly embarked on a journey of self-understanding. There have been numerous suggestions of alternate subtitles drawn from literature for your books. The one that struck me was God and the Getting of Wisdom.
Oh, that's an interesting alternative. I mean, God at the beginning seems to be full of power and very lacking in self-understanding. And at the end of the story, when we see him for the last time, it's a very old man. He's watching the world, and he seems to understand very well what is going to happen, but he is no longer attempting to project his power, as if having learned that perhaps that wasn't ever such a good idea.
The journey of him, as has been suggested by others, is the journey of us, because we are in his image, and in a sense he is in our image.
The journey of us is, if you want to state it in terms of an individual lifetime, I think it works a little better in the individual male lifetime. Cockiness at the beginning, full of himself, as people will say, of a young man making his way in the world.
And naive about the impact in some ways of his power.
And he doesn't know his own strength. He does not know. He doesn't know how much he can do. He doesn't know how little he can do. He doesn't know what the consequences are going to be of his own actions. And then gradually, as he gets older and weaker, he understands what he did do and what anyone can do, and he might wish to pass this on to his son or to some other young man or woman, but these things seem to be those that one must learn oneself. One can also draw the analogy to an entire civilization, take my country, the United States. Very full of power at the beginning, coming perhaps to some kind of peak as it intervened twice in European wars in the 20th century, and now perhaps sadder, wiser, and weaker at the same time.
Let's explore this journey a little bit, just for the sake of those who haven't read the books and might want to get in touch with them again. This first appearance of God, the young man, you beautifully describe the characters, the two sides of God that emerge through the way he's talked about in Genesis. Elohim, God, and the Lord. Mm-hmm. And these are different characters. One of them is that stately, grand presence. Mm-hmm. The other is somebody who is a little more ambivalent, wrestling and struggling with who he is.
A bit touchy also. Yes, in the first chapter of Genesis, God doesn't find it necessary to issue any prohibitions. He prepares an entire world for the first human couple and simply tells them to take possession of it. And be fruitful, breed, have children, and take this and make of it whatever you can. In the second chapter of Genesis, God, now going by another name, has to start all over again. It appears that the human creatures he made the first time have died, because now he's not dealing with their descendants. He's making a second human being in a somewhat different way. And this time he confines him to a garden, and he gives them instructions about what they may eat and what they may not eat. And when things don't work out, he explodes in anger and condemns them to death and to suffering in reproduction and labor.
The key thread through this seems to be coming to terms with an issue that of fertility. It's ultimately, the symbol of it is ultimately of circumcision, when Abraham and Isaac and a whole ritual of circumcision there. And this gets mixed up also with issues of fecundity. The whole fertility, sexuality thing is very interesting in the way in which it serves a literary purpose in the acknowledgement that God, in some ways, he's the only power he can exert early on, is to create in his own image. Mm-hmm. And that power is then passed on to others, mm-hmm, without the recognition of just the enormous potency of that whole thing. And that's why control of of fertility ultimately becomes a key thread in this story. Mm-hmm. Of course, psychically, it continues today.
Yes, it does. I mean, there is something miraculous about the phenomenon of human birth. You've probably spoken to young mothers or fathers who witnessed the birth of their first child, and they're struck with awe by what they're witnessing. It seems like a kind of miracle, though, of course, nothing is more natural. Well, God defines himself as a creator, and what he creates is reproductions of himself. Then his reproductions begin making reproductions of themselves, and now they look like him.
And begin in some ways to think they can behave like him.
That's right. So they have a quasi-divine power, and he, the true divinity, finds himself in a rivalrous relationship with those beings he himself has brought into existence. But then his attachment to them only grows the stronger because of this resemblance. Yes, the more your son looks like you, the harder you find to just wash your hands of him.
And the more potential conflict you have,
yes,
in a sense.
Yes,
and,
sure.
And this story of conflict and resolution proceeds through what Christians would call the Old Testament, in Jewish tradition, the Tanakh, and you take the Jewish ordering,
yes,
because it suits your literary unfolding of the story. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The two great significance moments that come later on is the emergence of God fully formed as a sort of mature young man, as the warrior God, mm-hmm, absorbed the elements of initial adolescence and becomes the warrior God, and then later, through a series of warrior encounters, begins ultimately to have to doubt whether or not this is the right way to go.
That's right. Then
the great final sequence in his encounter with Job, where the issue becomes not power, but physical power, but ethical power. And what is the right and what is justice ultimately? And it's a procession from energy to power to silence.
Energy to power to silence in the Tanakh. And it is striking, if you choose to employ the presence of an opponent, a Satan, a devil, a serpent, in the story as a plot element, that on the first encounter, the serpent wins. The serpent provokes God into destroying what he made, or marring it very massively. He couldn't say on the last day of creation, or he couldn't say after the sin of his first couple, that it is good. You know, they had done something to it, and then he had done something in reaction to them that constituted a victory for the serpent. And then the Satan appears again in the book of Job, and he provokes God into torturing an innocent man. And God expects that the innocent man will simply say, "The Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord," and shut up. But he doesn't. He keeps talking. He keeps saying, "How could he do this? This is not like him. I expect an explanation." Keeps saying that, and God gets angrier and angrier. But finally, at the end of the story, when he decides to restore Job's fortunes double, he says that all those who have been defending himself have been mistaken, and Job has been correct, which is a confession that he sinned.
This is ultimately God coming to terms with himself,
mm-hmm,
and in some ways the necessity to circumscribe himself.
He's learning from his own human creature. This is what one writer has called the lesson of Job, that even God can be led into doing evil. Every human being must recognize that about himself. We begin with a sense of our own innocence. Whatever we do with good intentions. And we must proceed to recognize our capacity to do evil unintentionally, but also sometimes to be led to do things that are intentionally hurtful.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. We're talking with Jack Miles, author of God, a Biography, and Christ, a Crisis in the Life of God. Jack Miles in Australia, and kindly consent to visit us on Sunday night. Jack, let's have a piece of music. We began with Gershwin from the original piano roll version of George Gershwin playing The Rhapsody in Blue. Some critics have noted that he takes that tempo very fast. It's an interesting observation about the way our perception of music changes over the years.
Gershwin seems to be a man possessed, and this is why I particularly like that performance, because for me it expresses not just what the notes are on the page, as a later performer might realize them, but what the initial inspiration must have been when Gershwin received it. And it was the marriage of an idea, a musical idea in his mind, a sound in his ears, and what he knew he could do with his amazing fingers. He was a fabulous, fabulous pianist. And this, to me, the intensity of that moment, endless staccato at blinding speed, stands for the peak experience of art. And there's been much discussion, as you know, about peak artistic experiences and how they differ, or whether they differ from peak religious experiences.
Let's take another one now, and that's Schoenberg. And you actually refer to Schoenberg in the text of your book as a peak artistic experience of the 20th century. Just describe for us why you chose to use this as an example.
Well, Arnold Schoenberg's Transfigured Night is an example of program music. It's music that is linked to a story, in this case, a story poem. And in that way, it makes clear something that had always been happening in a more intuitive way, without a close linkage, in romantic music. That is, people found their lives represented there, particularly the emotional crises of their lives, their most sorrowful moments and their most exultant moments in the passage from the one to the other. In this story, an engaged couple is walking in a park. She knows, he doesn't, that she is pregnant with another man's child. She doesn't love the other man. She loves her betrothed, who is strolling with her. But dare she tell him? And if she tells him, will she lose him? And you hear in the music the alternation of her agitation, her nervousness as she speaks to him, and then her deep, deep sorrow and anxiety, a burden, a heaviness in the music. And he says, I love you. We will raise the child that you are carrying as our son. And then there is this transformation to joy and to the excitement of a young couple who are trust each other completely and have only their wonderful future to look forward to. To me, this transformative moment, that's the title of the composition, after all, Transfigured Night. Her darkness is transfigured and transformed into light at that moment.
Perhaps Mary and Joseph.
Yes, I was writing about the Tanakh, so I put all such thoughts out of my mind, but now that you mention it. The connection that I make in the book is between God and Israel. And Israel has been scorned as a fallen woman. Israel has been like a prostitute, worshipping other gods, but now...
And quite specifically in Hosea, that's the imagery.
Yes, but now God is saying, I threw you out of the house, I divorced you, I had every right, but I'm taking you back.
Schoenberg, Transformed Night. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. Our guest is Jack Miles, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of God, A Biography, and Christ, A Crisis in the Life of God. Jack, let's talk briefly about the way in which we move from the Old Testament and the God of silence and musing and consideration of what he's done and whether he best leave us alone to Christ, a crisis in the life of God. I've already indicated this is something received somewhat differently because many people felt, hang on, you're intruding into a historical character whom we know. Mm-hmm. For you, this, however, is still an extension of the character of God, of mm-hmm. Christ, a physical person, all right, but still used in the Bible as a continuing part of the revelation. Here is a God who has truly come to terms with perhaps the damage that he may have inflicted on others and seeks recompense, in a way, by coming to terms, by identifying with, by joining in, by sharing the suffering of others.
Well, in most especially by sharing in the suffering of the Jews. During the siege of Jerusalem, the Romans crucified Jews by the thousands. The historian Josephus says that the hills were deforested. So many trees were cut down for crucifixions. So the God of the Jews joins his people. He suffers crucifixion with them as a way of saying something to them and to the world eventually that couldn't be said in another way. In the Tanakh, God was always the warrior who could be relied on to come to Israel's rescue. Now Rome appears as the equivalent of Pharaoh, but God does not perform this time as he did on that earlier occasion. Instead, he suffers what his people are going to suffer in their defeat. This is a way of saying military victory cannot achieve real redemption. It's a very disturbing message, and yet it isn't one that renounces all hope of victory. It simply redefines the terms of victory.
Because my kingdom is not of this world.
My kingdom is not of this world. It uses the notion of life after death, not an originally Christian notion, a Jewish notion, very well established by that time, and says, in effect, look, all of those who were rescued from Pharaoh eventually died, so what did that victory really mean to them? I promise you victory over death. And when you have that victory won, what does any defeat mean to you in this life?
The real shock for many people was, you were saying, this is a crisis in the life of God, because God is actually coming to terms with his failure or his sin, not ours.
I choose in this book to take seriously the simplest, most basic theological notion in Christianity, that Jesus is God incarnate. If Jesus is God incarnate, then we may read his story in the Gospels as an epilogue to the life of God. To do this is to do just what has not been done now ever since Albert Schweitzer wrote The Quest for the Historical Jesus. We have treated the historical character of Jesus as the object of all our interest, and bracketed as of no historical interest the notion that this man is God incarnate. For literary purposes, I take the theological notion seriously. I do it, as I say, as a literary trope. I'm not a theological belief. But if you do that, then wherever Jesus steps in the entire Holy Land, he's been there before, often more than once. And any statement that he makes can be heavy with allusion to his previous activity in that location. And what of his previous activity is particularly consequential? His promise after he took his wronged spouse, Israel, back into his embrace, that he would make it all up to her and then some. He would restore sovereignty and glory to Israel, as in the time of David, and he didn't do it. And now oppression has grown worse under the Greeks and still worse under the Romans, and a horrible war impends, and what is he going to do?
Indeed, he foreshadows a Holocaust, doesn't he? He foreshadows the destruction of the temple, or
yes.
as the Gospels narrate it.
Right. I agree with Jack Neusner, who says, this is a great rabbinic scholar in the United States, what is the consequence of the Nazi Holocaust to Israel? Absolutely nothing, says Jack. We were there before. We're still there. We're still doing what we always did. We won. They lost. And Israel was ready. Judea was ready for that tragedy, in which as many Jews or more died in the first century as died in the 20th century, because they had been through the experience of losing their temple before. They got the temple back, but as they lose it again, they're not without resources to recover and move on. And even when a third of the Jewish population of the world perishes in the 20th century, the religious resources of Judaism are equal to that challenge. Christianity was a response to the same challenge that took a different form. Instead of focusing entirely on the received scripture, that is, on Torah, now that animal sacrifice in the temple, which was the central act of the Jewish religion until that point, was no longer possible, Jesus created another kind of sacrificial ritual in which the one final sacrifice than which none could be greater, God's own death, would be reenacted for all time.
This is my body, this is my blood.
Correct.
It provides a wonderful literary arc, and you do an act of fusion. Let's then talk about why this is consequential. And this comes at the beginning and the end of your narratives. This, why do we need to bother about this? And it comes to actually the first discussion we had. What is it about this that has shaped us? And you usefully point out one of the ways this is important by taking us to the Shakespearean character of Hamlet. You point out the difference between Hamlet as a Shakespearean character full of doubt and wrestling with that and the tragedies that come, and Greek approach to tragedy. That in Greek approach to tragedy, fate leads us inexorably on. In the Shakespearean approach, it's the character itself that leads us there. And this has come out of the Bible. That is, we as a civilization have a different view of who we are because of this book.
In talking about the protagonist of the Tanakh, I understand him to be the result of the rise of monotheism, and I understand the rise of monotheism to be the fusing together of the specific personalities of the many gods of the Middle East. So that as a literary result, the God of Israel has many personalities within him, and they aren't always compatible. And this is the picture as well of Hamlet. Hamlet seems to be several different people. He seems to be chameleonic with his friends. He is one person with his beloved. He is another, and so forth. He doesn't seem to know who he is. Well, in a way, this conflict can be matched by conflict within the character of God, and it transmits itself then in a secularized form to our sense that if you want to know someone, you want to know what kind of conversation he has going on inside himself. Where are his struggles taking place? That's what makes for interest in another human being. If there are no struggles, there's not too much interest for us Westerners. When we turn to the character of Jesus, as I see it, it isn't so much this this multiplicity struggling for unity. It's rather the image that the last shall be first, and that the person who seems to be losing at any given point, who seems to be invisible and inconsequential, may actually carry the keys to power and the future. So the fascination of the underdog in our cultures comes in this way from the Christian story.
And there's another element too, read into that, is that that story is shared by a unique group of people who share that tradition, that is Jewish, Christian, and perhaps latterly Islamic civilizations. Mm-hmm. Other civilizations have a different understanding of the nature of the human person. Mm-hmm. The psychology may be profoundly different.
Yes, I think that in traditions that understand the life of the individual to take place over many eons, the urgency that is experienced to bring everything to a resolution within one lifetime is different. Really, there isn't as much urgency about it. It's been pointed out that India has its own versions of every art in the West except tragedy, because you can't have tragedy unless at a certain moment it's too late. And it's never too late in India. There's always another lifetime in which the mistakes of this lifetime may be atoned and repairs may take place. And this is the source of a certain kind of joy that a Westerner can sometimes envy in Indians who may be going through enormous tribulations, and yet there's a kind of cheerfulness, you know, that that it just seems unquenchable. You see this in the fiction of Narayan and certain other modern Indian writers who are describing the most agonizing suffering, and yet there's this chipper quality on the not. It's not pluck. It's not, you know, it's not British at all. It's really quite different. So I try to keep an open mind to entirely different ways of putting together a civilization.
You're on Sunday Night. Jack Miles is our guest. Jack, let's have another piece of music. Paul Simon, appropriately, still crazy after all these years.
Good.
Paul Simon is somebody who is, as a musical troubadour, actually picked up something that the Bible was doing, and perhaps we've lost it in contemporary song these days. He's trying to draw arcs of stories and pull them together and actually say that we've gone from somewhere and we're going somewhere, and here is where we are at the moment. Is there something engaging about it?
Well, I was in a perhaps slightly playful mood, but there's a serious dimension to this too. I imagine this very dramatic, melodramatic German couple finding their way to perhaps Australia or America. Maybe things didn't really work out for them in the long run. Who knows? In any case, wherever time and chance have taken them, they run into each other on the street, and they're so relaxed. This song has such a sense of mutual acceptance about it. We drank ourselves from a couple beers, still crazy after all these years. She seemed so glad to see me, I just smiled. That sense of the smiling wisdom that that is native to our culture at its best. It has no religious dimension to it, does it?
There is resolution in some sense.
That's there. There is reconciliation. If they were lovers, evidently they broke up. So there was anger, there were tears, other things have happened, time has passed, they meet each other again. It isn't necessarily the case that they're going to become lovers again. That's left hanging. But they can have a few beers and be friends.
I met my old lover on the street last night. She seemed so glad to see me, I just smiled.
Simon, still crazy after all these years. A selection of our guests, Jack Miles. Jack, that's probably a segue into where we're going to take this conversation now. Let's talk about then these incidental meetings along the years. One of the reasons you're here at the moment is to give a series of talks about the US today and the way you see them. To me, reading your books, there are some elements here that tease over, and that is the civilizational nature of what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. You wrote your books prior to 2001. Mm-hmm. In some ways, they've proved usefully prescient in that the what you are outlining there is a way of us coming to a self-understanding as a culture. And you're pointing to the need for us to actually come to self-understandings, or for cultures to come to understandings about who and what they are, what drives them.
Mm-hmm. After it was shortly after the publication of Christ, A Crisis in the Life, in the shadow of the bombings of 9/11, that I won a MacArthur fellowship. And I took some of the MacArthur money and put my services, such as they were, at the disposal of the Pacific Council on International Policy, which is an organization on the West Coast, like the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. I had urged on this organization when I was on the editorial board of the Los Angeles Times, and it was in its first organizational phase, that it pay more attention to religion as a civilizational factor in the time ahead. And all my thoughts were taken respectfully, but nothing really was done. In fact, political science as a discipline, until 9/11, paid very little attention to religion.
Yes, it was an incidental sort of epiphenomenon.
It was an epiphenomenon, exactly, and it achieved reality and consequence only when something about it at a given place and time could be translated into dollars or guns. That, I thought, was an inadequate way of grasping what could really be an independent variable in many complex equations. So it was in that mood that that I began thinking about the situation that my country found itself in, and I believe more broadly, Europe and the West finds itself in, vis-a-vis a broad, large, ongoing cultural encounter with the Ummah, the world Muslim community. It had begun well before 9/11, and it will continue well after 9/11 is a dim memory. It's something much larger than that. And the contribution in the broadest sense that I think I'm trying to make, I don't know whether I'm succeeding, has to do with the transferability of ideas and their changeability from one culture to the next. I remind my students that Europe has no religion of its own. European religion, to the extent that it's Christianity, comes from Western Asia. All of the religions of Europe, without exception, are dead. They whatever Europe was able to do for itself in religion didn't work out, and they dropped it and took an import. Well, now we have Muslims living among us. They come from the same religion, from the same region, at least those who are Arabs, where Christianity originated. And until 9/11, the Muslims in the United States were peacefully and in their own way and very successfully achieving a marriage of their religion and the cultural elements in it with American
cousins religion. In the family.
That's right. And it never occurred to Americans in our pluralistic society that this would become problematical. Now suddenly it has become. So the challenge now, in some ways, for the United States is to return to that happy condition that obtained before, and to allow the development of an American form of Islam to continue, and if anything beyond that, to valorize this by making it an important part of the face that America turns to the rest of the world. So our alternative to the picture of Islam and the West in a relationship that Al-Qaeda would like to present is the picture of Muslims and adherents of other religions in Western countries in a stance not of warfare but of cooperation and mutual respect.
Let me try and draw a couple of threads together out of this and perhaps ask you a provocative question. You're concerned with the sort of internal dialogue in the United States, the way things have to play out? You're suggesting religion, those things which drive us viscerally, is significant, and that we need to come to terms with the Muslims in our midst as brothers in a faith journey. Are you ever tempted to write an extended biography of perhaps the Prophet as a commentator on the life of God?
I'm not going to write a book on Muhammad. I mean, what would interest me would be a book on God as we hear him in the Quran. And God in the Quran speaks as a great corrector. He believes that his original revelation has been forgotten by the Jews and Christians, or it has been corrupted. It has errors have crept in, and now he is speaking again in order to bring about the necessary corrections, and Muhammad is just his messenger bringing this message of correction. So I would like, and I am working, it isn't easy, on a book in which I will juxtapose God's corrections in the Quran with the errors as we find them in the Christian and Jewish scriptures. And this ought to be instructive for all three traditions.
We look forward to the next installment. Jack Miles, it's been fabulous talking with you. Let's conclude with another piece of music that you've selected. This one quite quirky. It's a banjo used in quite a unique fashion. A banjo to give us Bach. Introduce it for us.
My brother is a professional banjo player, and he began doing bluegrass and the usual kind of American popular music. He progressed to jazz, then he discovered classical music, and he discovered that the banjo is tuned in a way that would enable one, if he were determined enough, and my brother was determined, to play even Bach's partitas for cello and violin on this instrument, and the results are quite fascinating.
Well, we can't bring you Michael Miles, but we can bring you John Bullard. Prelude from the Cello Suite No. 1 by Johann Sebastian Bach. Thanks very much for joining us, Jack Miles.
It's been a great pleasure, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S. Thank you for listening.